Well, I know you're all busy too. Hardworking, especially as this summer season begins to wind down, and we're coming very close now to our observance of, once again, the fall festivals. The Feast of Trumpets just a few weeks away. Feast of Trumpets is, to me, one of the most fascinating. Of course, they're all, in their own way, unique and fascinating, but the Feast of Trumpets in particular. The Feast of Trumpets is a one-day festival, but it represents an incredible series of events that will take place over an extended period of time. I would say at least one full year, and it's part of a much broader 3.5-year period of time, which the Bible refers to as the Great Tribulation. Our understanding of the Feast of Trumpets is central to our understanding of end-time prophecy. If we don't understand the Feast of Trumpets, then we don't really understand as those prophecies that will take place, that will occur during the time that that festival represents, leading up to it and including it. When we read scriptures that describe those times, I struggle to find a way to make those words into pictures, to visualize what is going to happen, what those days represent. If there was some way to capture those events on film, it would be the most spectacular science fiction movie ever produced. Now, I know a lot of you enjoy the sci-fi movie genre. Your Star Trek and Star Wars series of movies. There are other genres of fantasy movies and superhero movies and action movies. The one element they all have in common is that they strive to have amazing special effects that draw you into the scene, and it makes it feel like you're right there in the middle of what's happening. If you've ever seen one of these movies, maybe on an IMAX screen in 3D with super high fidelity surround sound, you are virtually right in the middle of what's happening. But you know, the thing is that the events represented by the Feast of Trumpets are not science fiction. They're not just some fantasy or some made-up story. What will happen in relation to, leading up to, and part of the Feast of Trumpets is the ultimate real reality. The festival represents a time during which the nations of the earth will be punished, and the church will experience a great deal of challenge and persecution as well. During the time that the Feast of Trumpets represents, Jesus Christ will deconstruct this world. He will systematically dismantle Satan's systems of religion, politics, government, education, entertainment, all the various ways that Satan has deceived, misled, confused, and controlled mankind for thousands of years. After Jesus Christ returns, he will reclaim authority over the earth, reduce Satan's world to rubble, and then he'll be prepared for the task, along with the resurrected saints, the task of reigning over and rebuilding the earth. Not just changing the earth, rebuilding all of the systems that lead or that are part of civilization. That's an incredible thing to think about. It's really beyond our grasp, because all we know is what we have lived with. And to try to imagine all of that being blown apart and then prepared to be rebuilt, it just I don't know. Like I said, I struggle to try to visualize just what that all means. As I've said before, the Feast of Trumpets is a transition. It reveals how we get from Satan's world to God's kingdom. So as we are approaching this special festival observance in just a couple more Sabbaths between now and then, I want to take some time to focus on or to look at the time frame and the events of that time frame. To appreciate the Feast of Trumpets itself, we need to kind of take a step back or move to an earlier point along the timeline of prophecy to consider events that will lead up to those events associated with the Feast of Trumpets. So today I want to focus on a particular aspect of prophecy which is currently being fulfilled and that will lead to the events represented by the Feast of Trumpets. The title of the sermon is The Beginning of Sorrows. As we go through, I want to kind of give make a statement as we begin, kind of a pre-disclaimer statement. When we talk about events at the end of the age, they're ominous. As we think about how it will affect people and perhaps us, it can be frightening, or at least worrisome. But I don't mean for this sermon to be some kind of my version of a hellfire and brimstone message to scare everybody about the future or to try to browbeat anyone to change or live any differently. I think the message itself carries that weight in terms of how it impacts us personally. I do believe this is a sobering period of time to consider, but I don't want to do it in a negative way. It is the tunnel, and we know that there's light at the end. So basically, today and the next Sabbath or two, we're going to make our way into the tunnel. We're going to look at some of the challenging events that will take place and consider the impact they will have not only on the world in general, but on God's people in particular. The Olivet prophecies are usually the starting point when we talk about or study end time prophecy. So let's begin there once again. This time let's look at Luke 21, verse 5. The Olivet prophecy, as it's known, it's a series, really, of prophecies that Jesus gave while he was on the Mount of Olives with his disciple, hence the name Olivet Prophecies. It's recorded in Luke 21, as well as in Mark 13 and Matthew 24. And as an interesting personal study, you might take the time to look at them side by side or read them together and notice the different emphasis that is made in different presentations of those prophecies. But in Luke 21, verse 5, we'll begin here today, says, as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, the some who were speaking of the temple were the disciples, as you see in the other presentations of this scene. The disciples were speaking about the temple and how beautiful it is and how it was constructed. The disciples were obviously had some sense of pride regarding the temple. They were, after all, Jewish, and the temple represented their heritage and their national, or at least their ethnic worship of God, even though it was not at that time a pure worship. Had become polluted in many ways, the temple still stood as a monument to the old covenant and to what God had given to his people, and that Judah was maintaining. So they were, in some sense, had kind of a national, I would call it, pride in that temple. So Jesus said to them as they were talking about it, to him it was, I guess, a teaching opportunity as they were looking at that building and how impressed they were with it and what it represents. Jesus said to them, verse 6, "These things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Talk about a conversation stopper. They were so impressed with the building, and Jesus tells them that, you know, one of these days is going to be completely, entirely destroyed. Not one of those massive, beautiful stones will be left upon another. They were so startled when Jesus made this statement that they wanted to know when and how this was going to come about. So they asked him, verse 7, saying, "Teacher, but when will these things be? And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place?" Matthew 24 reveals another aspect of this and part of the way of what they concluded, the disciples concluded when Jesus made this statement to them. Matthew 24, verse 3, again a parallel account. "Now as Jesus sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will all these things be?'" But I want to back up. I should have pointed out that again, he makes the same statement to them. Verse 1, his disciples, as they were coming out of the temple, had shown him the buildings and how meaningful it was to them. And Jesus made the same statement of Jesus is repeated in verse 2, that these things will be destroyed, not one stone will be left upon another. So the disciples asked him a particular question that indicated their understanding that an event so dramatic that the temple itself would be completely destroyed would signal the end of the age and would signal the beginning of Jesus' rule as the Messiah. That's what they concluded as they heard such a statement. It was so dramatic to them. From their reactions and comments, as you look ahead to what happened shortly after this, it's clear that when Jesus died, they didn't really fully understand what was happening. They didn't realize that Jesus was going to be killed and then resurrected, and then returned to the Father's throne for 2,000 years, and then finally return after the temple had been destroyed. They didn't have all that in order, but they knew that what Jesus had just said was something that meant that this age, the age in which that temple was so important, was ending, and a new age was beginning, the age of the Messiah. And so that's why they asked the question in this way, that this would be a sign of the change when Jesus Christ then would begin to rule and as the Messiah, as the King over the earth. And so again, we see here that they asked, well, then what will be the circumstances of that event? And how will we know that it's going to happen? In verses 4 through 7, we've read many times the answer that Jesus started with, that he began. He began by describing a number of conditions that would develop and that would continue. In these four verses, he mentions religious deception, ongoing warfare, natural disasters, drought, and famine, disease, and epidemics. These are the kinds of things that Jesus Christ warned would begin, warned to look for or to be aware of in the beginning of his explanation of what would be the sign that that temple destruction was coming and the sign that the age of Jesus Christ was going to begin. But as you come to the end of that list of events, you see in verse 8, Jesus says that all these are the beginning of sorrows. So Jesus makes it clear from the outset that these are not signs of his imminent return. This is the beginning of a time period of sorrow. These conditions that he described, in effect, are the natural consequences of Satan's world. These are the inevitable results that Satan's rule will lead to. As we look even in recent history, we know there have been terrible times of natural disaster. This weekend is the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And you may have seen some of the news specials looking back on what happened and what has happened since that took place. The most expensive in terms of dollars natural disaster in the history of the United States. Something near 2,000 people died. There are still bodies that have been recovered from the hurricane that have never been identified. Don't even know who they were. There have been some amazing and incredible disasters. Warfare. Think about the devastation that war has caused throughout the ages. We often think of the Holocaust. 6 million Jewish people killed in that one 6 or 7 year period of time. There have been some things that are unthinkable. There's been the threat of international epidemics, and that those fears hang over in many ways, that terrible things that could happen. In fact, oftentimes people look at some event that's taken place that would fit into these categories we're looking at here, and they ask themselves or they ask others, how much longer can this go on? How much more can the world take? And yet Jesus Christ said that this is not the end. This is not even what is part of the immediate warning of the events of the end. These are just the beginning of sorrows. This is just what's going to happen over the course of time. It's the way things are in this age. Verse 9 seems to kind of turn a bit of a corner, and it introduces a new development. This period of time, it says then, and the word then kind of gives an indication that it's something that follows in sequence, and when one part of it is finished, another begins. So these are the beginning of sorrows, and then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. So it's after the beginning of sorrows, but just glance ahead to verse 13. Those who are involved in this particular event or circumstance must endure to the end. So it's somewhere between the beginning of sorrows and the end of the age. It's a new development or wrinkle to the events that precede the end of the age. Verse 9 says, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. The implication is that besides everything else that's going on, there will come a time when the true disciples of Jesus Christ will suffer tribulation. Those who are what Scripture calls the saints, those who are not deceived, those who are not part of the world system, and elsewhere they're called the elect. And we'll just refer to them as God's church, will suffer tribulation, severe persecution, and even martyrdom. This happens, again, before the end time sequence begins, which is referred to in verse 13. The word tribulation can have a general meaning and it can also have a specific meaning. It can be translated trouble and suffering. It also can be translated persecution. In this case, here in verse 9, it's describing the persecution of, well, it says you. You, they will deliver you up to tribulation. He's speaking to his disciples and looking at this in a prophetic perspective. He's speaking to his people through the ages, and in particular, just before the end of the age. Those disciples to whom he spoke, those 11 who were faithful and one more who was added later, those original disciples or apostles did suffer personally and suffer greatly for the commitment they'd made to Jesus Christ. All of them, so far as we know, except the Apostle John, were martyred. Others in the church also endured great persecution as they were forced out of their homes, forced out of their communities, scattered throughout the region because they believed in, because they taught and followed Jesus Christ. But the description given here seems to reach beyond just those immediate 12 original apostles and beyond the period of time right then at the beginning of the church, and that it will be a general persecution that will affect many who are disciples. As we continue through this chapter, again, we notice that at the beginning, Jesus describes general events that are not directly related to the end of the age. But as we continue through, it is in a time order or sequence. And what's mentioned here in regard to the tribulation or persecution does occur, brings us down to up to the time at the end of the age. We looked earlier, a couple of weeks ago, at a prophecy. Let's look at it again in Revelation 13. It's an end time prophecy, clearly, being here in the book of Revelation. And without going into detail and to examine the entire chapter, you'll see in verse 1 and then in verse 11 that there are two different great powers that are being described in this chapter. What I want to emphasize is in verse 7, because it relates to what we see in Matthew 24. In verse 7, in Revelation 13, speaking of this first great beast power that arises at the end of the age, says it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. In other words, wherever God's true disciples, wherever the elect, wherever the saints are, they will be affected by this tribulation or persecution that will come upon the saints at the end of the age. It says that this great power will overcome them. In other words, it will, at least for a time, have the authority to control or to persecute them extensively. If you refer there, consider what the wording is here in verse Matthew 24:9. It says that his disciples will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. When you read that, just look at it quickly. You might, well, why would the nations hate God's people? Why would all the nations hate God's people? Well, putting it together with Revelation 13, we see it's because the one who really hates God's people is Satan, who's inspiring this great power that will have dominance at the end of the age to trouble, to persecute, and will be given authority to overcome God's people. So this great beast power that's been described in Revelation 13 will turn the people of the world against the saints of God in every nation. And it's a little bit like, we might compare at least in a superficial way to the mission that Saul went on when he was persecuting the church. He was hunting down the people of God. He was chasing them from one location to another to persecute them. And so there will not be a location on the earth where God's saints, his people at this time that's being described, will be, in effect, safe from the power that will be granted to that individual. Now we're going to see as we continue, and probably in another message, not this one, we'll focus on it more specifically, that many of the saints, many of the elect, will be protected from the worst of this persecution. Jesus himself spoke of it. But when we look at Matthew 24:9 and scriptures that in this context, we'll see that we'll see that while some will be protected, frankly, not all will be given that protection. Not all of the saints will be sheltered from those events that will take place. It's also clear from this scripture in Matthew 24 that the persecution described here comes upon the elect or the saints before that period of protection is given to the church. So what we can take from what Jesus says here in Matthew 24, that there will be some faithful disciples, faithful saints, at the end of the age who will suffer a great deal. Not a pleasant time to think about. Continuing in verse 10, it says, and then, so this kind of follows as a result of this tribulation and persecution, and because of that, or then, many will be offended and will betray one another and will hate one another. Jesus seems to be warning that this intense persecution, tribulation, will lead to some confusion even among the disciples, even among the elect. Now, this part here about brethren betraying one another is a troubling thought, isn't it? But we know that from just observing things that have happened in the past, that under the threat of severe circumstances, people will often revert to doing whatever they can or whatever they think they have to protect themselves or to protect family. And so it seems that some of those elect will be offended, will be tripped up by the difficult times that they're experiencing, and will, in effect, just turn against one another. And it says they'll hate one another. Now, this is a picture not necessarily just of the church, but of society in general. That, again, as we saw in Revelation 13, and noted here in verse 9 of Matthew 24, all the people will be focused on and be hateful toward those who are disciples. But there is at least some implication that it will affect those who are among the disciples, those who are among the elect. And then we continue on then to compound or to add to or sequentially see the development of this series of events. Many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. So this is kind of an intensification of the misrepresentation. Jesus warned that from the very outset that people would be deceptive and have a false message about the Christ. But because of the difficult times and the suffering that many people are enduring, that will give rise to even more false prophets. And even more will rise up and maybe offer their solutions or offer their explanations or offer some way that supposedly will bring relief. And these false prophets and those circumstances will deceive many more. All right, so when we see this, these circumstances building, let's back away from those just for a moment. And let's think about what it is, if these events are going to become so intense and will affect even some members of the elect or the saints or the church in these ways, how can we possibly be protected from them? How can we not be among those who turn against, who are offended, who wind up following a false prophet? Well, let's come back on that timeline to today, where we are now, and what this means in a practical or in a realistic sense, a relevant sense. What does all this mean for us right now? Consider Ephesians, the fourth chapter. Ephesians chapter 4. We'll just use this as one example. There are many other passages that you can turn to, both by in Peter and Paul's writings, and even the other general epistles as well, written by the other apostles. But let's look at the way that Paul helps us to look ahead, to be prepared for difficult times that could come in our lifetime. Talking about the church that we are all part of. And one of the themes of the letter to the Ephesians is the unity of God's people, the unity of God's church, that we're being built into the temple of God. We're being knit together. We're being brought together to be a unified group. And that's a challenging process. It's not a natural thing for us, although maybe in a local congregation we know each other well and we've been together for a long time, we can see this happening, but it's not a simple thing to bring people in, and Paul's here is emphasizing the bringing in of Gentiles with the Jewish members and knitting them together into a family. But that's one of the themes of being unified, and that's one of the results of being part of this church. Notice verse 11, Ephesians 4, he himself, Jesus, gave, this is within the church, some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, various positions of leadership and responsibility in the church. Why? Verse 12, for the equipping of the saints, for the ministry, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. Till, okay, so we're being knit together, we're being led and being taught by this structure of the church until we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of Man, to a perfect man or a mature person, to the measure and the stature of the fullness of Christ. We're part of God's church, the church that Paul is describing. The purpose of the church is to give us an opportunity to be solidly founded upon and become mature in our understanding of, to be led to become like Jesus Christ, measuring up to the fullness of his example or his stature. God has drawn us together to teach us how to be in his family, how to be his family. And he's given us a structure to give us that guidance and that help. Let me read this to you from the New American Standard updated translation. It's an excellent word-for-word kind of a translation that will clarify some of the language sometimes. The New American Standard puts it this way, beginning in verse 12. Okay, we're talking about the purpose of the structure of the church. Verse 12, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of service, to the building up of the body of Christ. The word equip that's used here is from a Greek word that means to arrange or to put in proper condition or to prepare. The structure of the church is provided for us so that we are prepared to do the work of service in God's church and in God's family. We're being arranged. We're being put in proper functional condition so that we can serve within God's church, the edifying or building up of the body. Verse 13, again, still from the NASU, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a mature person, to the measure of the stature which belongs to the fullness of Christ. But notice verse 14. Here's where it all leads. So that, as a result, we are no longer to be children, tossed here and there by waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by craftiness and deceitful scheming. You see, in Matthew 24, Jesus warned that in the future there will be a time of strong deception, of trickery, and of scheming. Paul helps us see that it's so important that we use the time we have now. Our lives now, relatively peaceful and safe. Now is the time to learn and to be taught as part of God's church, and to teach that way to our own children, to establish a foundation. We have now the opportunity to grow spiritually in the unity, in the knowledge of God, in a time of peace. So that if or when that peace is threatened in the future, we will have our lives established on a solid foundation. We will not be prone to being tossed around by false teachings, by the trickery of men. Satan will use men to deceive, especially at the end of the age. If we focus now on personally growing to the measure of the fullness of Jesus Christ and his example, if that is the focus of our intent in our lives, then we are building that foundation which will not be shaken, even in those times of severe stress. Jesus warned us of the times that are going to come, and we look at those words by themselves, and they can be frightening. I don't want to have to go through that kind of an experience. None of us would anticipate it in a positive way. But he also gives us encouragement to help us understand that we can be strong and to stand. We will not be among those who becomes confused, who is tossed to and fro, and deceived and drawn away by a false teacher, by false explanation of prophecy or of events. Again, we look ahead to the Feast of Trumpets, and it really should be a very sobering time for us to consider. Again, we're in the tunnel, or we're headed toward the tunnel, and we have to get through that period of time to get to the light at the end. The Feast of Trumpets serves as a reminder of difficult times at the end of the age and of how essential it is for those who live in that time to be prepared. I often, constantly mention, that we don't know for sure that we're that generation, but I don't think we ought to rule it out. I don't think it would be safe to assume that we're not. And after all, Jesus said further in Matthew 24 that all of his disciples at all times should always be ready for his return. So it doesn't matter really when these things will take place in that sense. He still expects us to consider them and to be prepared as if they will occur in our lifetime. I started some time ago with a whole series of sermons based on 1 Corinthians 16. And I'll go ahead and tell you what my strategy was. It may not be apparent. But I want to be focused on, I want to, for us to be focused on the strength we need in our lives as we move toward whatever is in our future. We have to be watchful. We have to stand fast in the faith. We have to be strong. We have to have courage. We have to have a deep love and commitment to one another. All those are the basic statements that Paul made in 1 Corinthians 16. They're all part of what he's referring to here in Ephesians 11 is establishing the foundation in our lives so that if these events take place, it's not as if we can walk into them all proud and happy and smug that it's not going to touch us, but at least we will have. We shouldn't have that arrogant kind of an attitude, but we should have, based on our efforts now, a sense that of faith and of assurance that whatever God has in mind for us, he's also given us a way to be prepared. We don't like to dwell on the bad news. We come to church to be encouraged, come to services to look ahead to the good times, and that's all well and good. But sometimes we also have to be reminded, or we have to let Scripture remind us of the difficult times that come first. Because there are stormy times coming, and that whether it's in our personal lives or whether it's looking ahead to those difficulties at the end of the age, let's look at what Jesus said in Matthew 7. Matthew 7, verse 24. We saw that Paul tells us to be mature and not to be children any longer, so we won't be tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine. Here's the way Jesus expressed in a different way expressed the same point. Matthew 7:24. At the conclusion of this Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, look, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I'll liken him to a wise man who builds his house on the rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and it beat on that house, but it didn't fall because it was founded on the rock. A familiar statement and passage, a familiar analogy or metaphor. There are storms and difficulties in life. That's true in general. But we also notice it is specifically true in an especially intense way for those who will live into this prophesied time of persecution and of tribulation. We prepare for the storms of life, whether they be the storms and the struggles of what we might call everyday life, or whether we're talking about the time that is to come. We prepare for those storms by the way we live every day. Every day that we observe, that we obey, that we're careful about how we live, the kind of person we are, our application of God's instruction in our lives. Every day, as we live in that way, through the routine of life, we're building that structure. As we seriously make an effort to overcome those areas of character flaws or weakness, those habits that we know aren't to be part of a Christian's life, as we're doing what we need to do every day in this ordinary time of life, at least by comparison, then we are, in effect, building that foundation so that when the storms come, and it says they beat on the house. So this is a Katrina-type storm that's coming through. You saw the pictures, interesting kind of a contrast. We saw pictures of homes on the beach or homes that were close to the Gulf in New Orleans that were just completely obliterated, nothing left but the foundation. They compared that to a hurricane that came through, I think it was Corpus Christi. sometime later. And they had learned from what had happened in Louisiana, and they had built those homes on solid foundations. And when the storm, I had to go back and look to see which hurricane it was, but when it had passed, the houses were there. They weren't washed away. A very graphic and literal example of what Jesus is speaking of here. That we will be able to stand so long as we build our lives on that foundation. So yes, the times that lie ahead are frightening, but it's not as if we go into them either blind or without assurance that God will bring us through those times, if, again, we are that generation that will deal with them. Let's go back to the Olivet prophecy of Luke 21. Verse 12. This is talking about, again, that time of persecution. Luke 21:12. Before all these things, they'll lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You'll be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. But it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you'll answer, but I will give you a mouth of wisdom and wisdom, which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. That adds a little more of a sense of what's going to happen, that there will be times when the saints, the elect at this point, will be given the responsibility to stand up for what they believe and to defend it. And God will give wisdom to those in that situation so that they'll be able to give an answer that can't be contradicted. But again, I would suggest that that kind of a connection to God, that kind of background understanding and ability to defend God's way will be given to those who have that foundation. You're not going to recall something you haven't learned. You're not going to, you know, if you're in that situation, then certainly we can trust that God will give us the strength, the courage, and the wisdom to deal with it. But it also would be a case where we need to be prepared. Not necessarily, as it says, not thinking of all the answers you're going to give, but we prepare by building our house on that rock. We prepare by becoming mature Christians, unified and integrated into God's church, as Paul described in Ephesians 4. And when that time comes, God will provide the help that a person needs. Verse 16 says, you'll be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends, and some of you they'll put to death. That's pretty much what Matthew had said as well. You'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. But, okay, let's see, they're going to betray you. They're going to put you to death. They're going to you'll be attacked by your closest friends and relatives, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. What? We're putting things into a greater context here. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, don't fear those who can kill the body, but those who can kill the body and the soul. In other words, Jesus is saying, look, even if this costs you your life, then what you are really about, what God has promised to you, is not going to be taken. We look at life and death and even persecution and difficulty and struggle in a whole different way because we don't like to be in that kind of a situation. None of us would want to be one of those who is a martyr, the one who is put to death. But if your belief and your faithfulness to God costs you your physical life, then what you really have to look forward to is not going to be lost. It's not going to be harmed. It's not in jeopardy. Because you know what the greater picture is. At the moment, it might seem like the ultimate tragedy. You know, again, we saw in Revelation 13 that Satan will be given authority to overcome the saints. So it's a serious situation. But the overall eventual outcome is not changed. Matthew 10, verse 16. This also speaks of persecution that will come. Matthew 10, verse 16. And this is specifically to the disciples as they were being sent out. If you go back to verse 1 in this chapter, you can see that the 12 were being sent out on a mission, perhaps to get some experience or practice in what they would later be called upon to do as apostles. But drop down to verse 16, Jesus explains to them, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. You'll be brought before governors and kings for my name's sake as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you will speak. For it will be given to you in that hour what you should speak." Same, a different description, and this is not related specifically to the time at the end of the age. But the point is made once again that those who are part of the way of life, the disciples, the representatives, the elect, those who are in God's church, will find that circumstance challenged. The only way to prepare for that is what we've talked about in terms of what we saw in Ephesians 4 and in Matthew 7. Back to Matthew 24 again now, verse 12. As all this develops, as there is tribulation, as there is offense, as there is a growing number of false prophets and deceitful messages. Verse 12 kind of summarizes the whole scene that this will create. And it says, "Because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold." Lawlessness is sin. It's the same word used here as is used in 1 John 3, 4. It's sinful behavior. Because sinful behavior or lawlessness will abound, then the love of many will grow cold. This again shows that the events happening, as they're developing, we see beginning in verse 9, this new and more intense phase of what's coming about, leading to the end times. This lawlessness prevails in society in general, and it will have an impact on some in God's church. Some in God's church, if they're not as strong, as well-founded, as mature as we should and can be, may fall prey to this kind of a system. You see, in Satan's system, there's no sin. In Satan's way, people make all their own choices, choose any lifestyle, any orientation, any gender they want. They can be whatever they want to be, do whatever they want to do. Nothing is wrong. They make their own choices, which is exactly what he convinced Eve of way back in the Garden of Eden. You don't need God to tell you what to do. You can decide that for yourself. And so there is a strong appeal to that. Now, we saw back in earlier in this chapter the terrible results that come about from Satan's system, but this is the way that people are taught to live. And it will have some impact as it develops, even on some who are among the elect. And many of them will grow cold, and their love of God's way, of God's law, of God's people will grow cold. Remember how the people who fall prey to the delusion are described in Second Thessalonians, those who have not received the love of God's law. So you could dwell on that thought about the love that we have for each other, the love that we have for God's way, the commitment that we have for it. It's going to be challenged. Not going to be an easy time. But, verse 13, he who endures to the end will be saved. A couple of important thoughts there. First of all, there's still a ways to go to the end. For all this that's happened, all this has been described, we're not to the end yet. You have to get through the circumstances described in verses 4 through 7, through the tribulation and the trial and difficulties described in verses 9 through 12. You have to endure all that all the way to the end, because the end is not yet come. But it also says that if we endure to the end, then we'll be saved. We will reach that positive, ultimate outcome that we're looking for. We'll receive the salvation that God, that Jesus Christ will bring with him. You might compare that statement in verse 13 to Luke 21:19, because really, although they're worded very differently, they're saying the same thing. Luke 21:19 says, by your patience, possess your souls. In the Greek, the words translated patience and endurance are the same. Luke 21:19 is also talking about endurance. Endurance, you know, you can define it in different ways. It requires patience, courage, strength, determination. Patience and endurance are very much the same, very similar in what they describe. So in these initial verses that Jesus spoke following the question that he was asked, there's a great deal of for us to consider. In terms of the world around us and in terms of our own lives and what we can learn, how we can apply the lesson of those times to come to our lives every day. Now, as I said at the outset, the Feast of Trumpets represents an incredible series of events which will lead to and bring about the establishing of God's eternal kingdom. That's absolutely a positive message. It's a message of hope, a message of promise. But we also see that the transition from this age to that time to come is going to be real challenging. It's going to be a very difficult time on many different levels. It's something that we must be aware of and be prepared for. Next time, what I plan to do is to carry on from this point, and we'll talk about what happens then in this sequence. We'll talk about the connection between Revelation 6 and Matthew 24. And we'll talk about the period of time that's introduced in verse 21 of Matthew 24, the time of the Great Tribulation, and see once more how it affects the world, how it affects the church, and what it is we should be aware of, and see how that leads into. See, we're not yet to the Feast of Trumpets. All of this builds up to what the Feast of Trumpets represents. But we won't appreciate fully the meaning of that day unless we consider, at least consider some of the, what we can of the background of what leads to it. So, certainly something you might want to give thought to and give some study on yourself as well as we move on now through the next few weeks to observance of that very special holy day.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen.